Back together again, you and I chatting it up, wrapping up a very busy week, Friday, June 14th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. We kicked off the show looking at another local municipality that looks like it's ready for more electronic traffic enforcement measures. WTNH News 8's Mike Cerulli, host of WICC's Mike Cerulli Show every Saturday, stopped by and looked at the past week's big political stories in the state. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso stopped by with his thoughts on the latest election controversy in the Park City, and finally Wesleyan University graduate Andrew Bridge, author of The Child Catcher, A Fight for Justice and Truth, told us about his experience as a foster child and the legal career that he's undertaken to help others like him.
Another friendly reminder from your friendly afternoon talk show host from 2 to 6 right here. Learn how to use a brake pedal. Learn how to use a brake pedal. Learn how to say, hey, if I know there are red light cameras around here, and if I know there are speed cameras around here, and I know that I might get caught on photo radar, whatever, maybe I should speed down. Slow down, rather. Not speed up, but slow down. Especially if you're in the town of Stratford. Stratford says here, how about this? Richard Chumney's story here today in the Connecticut Post as we start off with this action-packed show, by the way, coming up. A lot going on today. Stratford, here it comes, folks. I know people aren't going to like this, and I know they're going to say, hey, it's Big Brother. It's just a money-making plan. Well, you know what? Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But the only reason cities and towns are doing this is because people won't slow down. People drive like jackasses. Stratford Way's installing speed and red light cameras at busy intersections. The town council weighing a plan, says here, to implement the cameras for red lights and speed to ID and fine motorists who break the law. The 10-member panel began on Tuesday a discussion of a new ordinance that will allow local officials to issue citations based on images captured by yet-to-be-approved cameras. State lawmakers voted last year to give municipalities across Connecticut the option, it's not mandatory, but the option of setting up automated traffic enforcement cameras, partly in response to an increase in deadly motor vehicle crashes. I have no problem with this. I have zero problem with this. I've almost gotten T-boned several times, only to get flipped off by the person who T-boned me or almost T-boned me. I told you about a year and a half ago, I was doing my nightly little saunter around the middle of Wallingford, and three cars, one, two, three, right after the other, completely blew a stop sign at a crosswalk I was in, and they almost did it in kind of a taunting manner, like, hey, pal, we're not slowing down. And the last person driving, a rather large and zoftic woman, gave me the one finger salute, to which I told her where that finger could go. So if it at least gets back at people like this, I am all for it. The law gives towns and cities the power to issue $50 tickets for the first infraction, $75 fines for subsequent offenses, and up to, I love this, $15 in fees for processing electronic payments. There's the twist of the knife right there. That's beautiful. All right, you got me. That's my car. Yep, you send me the ticket. There's the image on camera. All right, fine, whatever, I'll pay. Oh, by the way, $15 to pay. The cameras would capture the license plates of cars traveling 10 miles or more, 10 miles per hour or more above the speed limit or running a red light. Well, that's it. So they're not going to get you for going 36 in a 35. They will get you for going 45 in a 35. So don't go 45 in a 35. Don't go 50 in a 40. Don't go 35 in a 25. It's pretty easy. And don't blow through the red light. Now, will there be probably some time where this whole thing is going to have to be adjusted? Yeah, well, you know, we have to make sure people aren't slamming on the brakes or speeding up at these red light cameras. All right, yeah, I give that to you. But I don't know about you, and you can let me know here. We'll start off the Friday with this at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, especially if you are in Stratford. Now, Mayor Laura Hoidick, and you tell me what you think about this and whether or not this placement is good. You'd like more of this or less of this or somewhere else. Mayor Laura Hoidick said police department officials have already ID'd multiple sites in Stratford, including the busy intersections at Barnum Avenue and Main Street and Barnum and Broadbridge Avenues. We all know where those are. The mayor saying the town plans to obtain the cameras from a vendor that will cover the cost of installing the equipment. The company, which has not yet been selected, would then split the ticket revenue with the town. So there you go. So it's not like the town is getting all the ticket money. Stratford's among several localities now considering the cameras, a list that also features Bridgeport, Stamford, and Hartford. But see, this is the part that drives me nuts. Critics, including the Connecticut chapter of the NAACP, have suggested the cameras raise civil liberty concerns, especially for residents in low-income and minority neighborhoods that have traditionally faced higher levels of police surveillance. So again, I will ask the question, does this mean that black people and Hispanic people don't know how to use a brake pedal? Well, you shouldn't say that, Paul. Why not? Because this is asinine. The notion that the NAACP and other people are saying, hey, well, you know, these speed cameras. Wait a minute. Hold on. You think that parents and folks living in black and Hispanic neighborhoods and kids living there shouldn't be as safe as the people living in white neighborhoods? Can you be a little more bigoted than that? Well, you know, we don't want these, speed surveillance in black and Hispanic neighborhoods. No, we don't need that. Let the whiteys do that. This sort of stuff drives me nuts. And the state bought into it. The state setting some limits on the number of cameras in, I love this, economically disadvantaged communities. Why? Even if you, I know a lot of people that don't have a lot of money. In fact, I know a lot of poor people that don't have a lot of money, and they still know how to use a brake pedal. Amazing, isn't it? For example, localities will only be allowed to install up to 2 camera systems in census tracts with the highest concentrations of poverty. Please explain that to me. I don't understand. Well, I know what it is. It's racial politics. It's soft bigotry, saying, well, you know, black and Hispanic people shouldn't speed, but we're okay with them having less of a chance being caught because, of course, we don't care about the safety of black and Hispanic children. We don't care about the safety of black and Hispanic hardworking people in neighborhoods. We don't care about the safety of black and Hispanic kids around their schools. According to a copy of the draft ordinance being considered now in Stratford, the list of acceptable defenses. Now, people always ask about this. Hey, what if I want to argue with the automated ticket? The list of acceptable defenses that would exempt someone from paying a fine include driving an emergency vehicle and complying with the directions of a traffic cop. I would think. So the town council voting unanimously to refer the automated traffic camera proposal to the ordinance committee. The committee set to meet next on June 24 according to town documents. And again, this is how this thing is going. So again, you have 2 or 3 levels of acceptance here in the city or town before they can make a formal application to the state. To do this, and the DMV has to look at it, and they have to make sure you're not setting up traffic stops here. But again, you know, Stratford seems to be full speed ahead with this. They're looking at several areas, according to the police department, the police chief, and Mayor Laura Hoidick, who said they will at least start possibly or probably at Barnum Avenue and Main Street and Barnum and Broadbridge Avenues. Any ideas? Any other ideas where they should start? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. This notion, though, that there have to be fewer cameras in poorer census tracts is mind-numbing. Isn't the law the law? Well, you know, a lot of minorities may get caught up in this. So you're telling me then that safety in a black neighborhood or safety in a Hispanic neighborhood or any low-income neighborhood is not paramount to safety in a white neighborhood. So somebody who lives maybe in an economically depressed part of Bridgeport or Hartford or New Haven, they don't get to have the same level of safety and surveillance and scrutiny than somebody who lives in Wilton or Westport or New Canaan or Fairfield or Weston or Wilton. I don't know. I'm having a little trouble. I know it's Friday. I know I'm a little slower on this day of the week, but I'm having a bit of trouble. Let's kick off the phone parade today. We'll check in with Joe in Madison. Joe, you're on WICC. How are you?
Hey, good afternoon, Paul. I'm not going to touch the minority situation you're going into, but I am going to talk about our infrastructure in a lot of municipalities leaves a lot to be desired, and that's why the motorists are frustrated. I agree with you. People shouldn't run lights, shouldn't run by school buses or whatever. Mm-hmm. However, there's a flip side of this, that the roads in our towns are not being properly maintained, and they haven't been widened, and they haven't had an additional intersection, right turn on red. And so people are frustrated when they wait two or three times for a light that turns red, and they haven't gotten through the intersection. So how about commenting on the infrastructure?
Well, you know, and Joe, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. And I think that, yeah, I mean, I find myself, in fact, I found myself almost today doing that. I was out running around town before I settled in for the show today. And a lot of you people don't realize this, but you know, when you're on a, let's say, I was on Route 5 in Wallingford. I was running around doing my usual morning stuff, coffee, bagel, donut, and all that. And there was a car in front of me, and this car was making a left turn. And I catch myself a lot saying, hey, you're not supposed to pass the car on the right. And that's a common thing that people do. As an example of what Joe said, you know, that there's not enough room on these roads. And so people, what do? You automatically shift over and go around the car. You think that's all right. It's not, because you're driving around. Number one, you're passing somebody on the right side, where their field division is not the best. And number two, you're doing part of that usually on the shoulder of the road. Now, to Joe's bigger point, yeah, if the roads were wider and if they were better serviced to maintain, maybe people wouldn't do that. But again, yeah, Joe, I know you're feeling, we're all frustrated on this, but man, oh man, you got to bite your tongue sometimes. And maybe, all right, you know, I'm all, as the young kids like to say, I'm down with that. You know, maybe some of this money, is it going to end up going for road improvements or improvements in infrastructure? Maybe. So again, it looks like Stratford, and I know there are some other Fairfield County cities or towns that are saying, yeah, we know what's going to upset people, but we're going to go ahead and do this because people are driving like crazy. And it really got nutty, right, during COVID. I remember being on the highways in the middle of the day during COVID. There's nobody there. And you look down and you're doing 70, 75, 80, as isolating as these cars are, it is what it is. A new addition to the radio station here, our programming lineup, is, of course, the Mike Cerulli Show every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. right here on WICC and all of our various channels, 600 a.m., 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. You see this gentleman a lot on News 8, also writes at our buddy Tom Dudchick's Capital Report, ctcapitalreport.com. And Mr. Cerulli is here, as he is joining us now every Friday to preview the weekend. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Doing well, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. And you were right up front in the indictments, Mike, that came down after, geez, it only took 5 years, but in the first go-round of alleged, we should be proper here, alleged election funny business. And you actually went to the home and talked to one of the, to the husband of one of the people in the spotlight on this, Mike, a few days ago.
That's correct, Paul. When the news broke Tuesday morning that we were seeing arrests and charges in the case, as you mentioned, from 2019, not from the videos we all saw just last year. I was thinking about this, and it actually dawned on me. I was a senior in high school when all of these, things allegedly
played. You're getting old, Cerulli. You're getting old.
now have the opportunity to cover them 5 years later. So, yeah. The first thing that we thought when we heard this news was, look, Wanda Jeter-Padicki, who was arrested and charged, along with three other individuals for those alleged ballot crimes and also for alleged witness tampering. She was also at the center of the 2023 scandal, as you'll all remember. Mm-hmm. So the first thought I had was, well, let's talk to lawyers. Let's talk to some local Bridgeport officials. But we have to go try and talk to Wanda, because she is the tie that kind of threads 2019 to 2023 and tells the story usefully, I think, of more systemic problems that are happening in Bridgeport. So went over to her house. I wasn't able to find her, but her husband was just happened to be standing outside. Walked up to him. Honestly, was expecting, you know, a no comment, but he was more than willing to talk to us.
I saw that.
Him
yeah.
some questions. Yeah, yeah. It was an interesting conversation for sure. They believe these charges are politically motivated. They believe it's based on hearsay. The arrest warrants and the affidavits tell a different story, but that's what Mr. Paddocky was saying to me, was that he believes it's politically motivated and hearsay.
Yeah, so we'll see how that all shakes out. A lot more to cover there, Mike. One of the other stories from a few days ago, as promised, Mike Cerulli, the governor vetoes, you know, something that he says, a measure that he says, the theory of such, you know, he said he's not sure that he approves of it. But I tell you, Mike, I think the governor really put his foot down on this, and you kind of know he did with the reaction from organized labor and some people in his own party. He did not like at least the way that this last-minute piece of legislation was put together concerning possibly aiding strikers who otherwise would not get any sort of unemployment or something like that.
That's right. That's right. Too cute by half was the phrase he used for it when he first indicated that he would veto this legislation. And yeah, it started out at the beginning of the legislative session as a priority for Connecticut labor leaders, which was to ensure unemployment benefits get extended to striking workers. Of course, in the last year, we've seen many high-profile strikes, United Auto Workers, the Writers Guild of America, the Screen Actors Guild, which I am a member of as an on-air performer at News 8. We saw strikes of the theatrical wing of that union this last year. So, you know, unions have been looking to bolster their power. They've increased membership in some areas, and obviously, if they had access to unemployment benefits, that would greatly bolster their ability to maintain long strikes. So there was a bill that explicitly did that. That bill was negotiated into this unspecified account to assist low-income workers that was understood by everyone involved to basically be the unemployed benefits by another name. The governor did not like that. He said that, again, too cute by half. He thought the method by which they were going to deliver this aid wasn't clear. It was the result of a deal that was struck in the last few weeks of the session. And so he vetoed that legislation, sent it back to the legislature. And now, based on all indications, labor could certainly try again for this type of legislation in the future.
You know, Mike Cerulli, and Mike Cerulli's the guest. Mike Cerulli program tomorrow, 10 to 1 on WICC. I said the other day on my show, Mike, I said, you know, I'm not surprised labor feels the way it did, but instead of saying, hey, you know, we respect what the governor did, we will move next session to make sure, you know, Mike, that the governor's concerns about this are not founded, we'll mold it to his liking. But they didn't do that, Mike. This was like a roadrunner dropping the anvil here on Wile E. Coyote. I mean, here they are appointing a member of their own party who honestly is not uber progressive, but, you know, likening him with his corporate CEO friends and saying he doesn't stand up for the working person. Were you at all surprised in the tone that organized labor took in this, aiming at the governor or not?
No, it wasn't too surprising. Ed Hawthorne, the president of the Connecticut AFL-CIO, is a very assertive leader on behalf of his member workers. And as I said, this is all happening against the backdrop of a very revitalized American labor movement. They feel emboldened. You know, and I should actually say we feel, because I am part of that. I'm proud to be part of a union, understanding, of course, that has to take a back seat when I'm covering these issues. But I would say the labor movement feels emboldened by the success, particularly of those UAW strikes in the last few months that delivered a good contract for those UAW workers when they did the stand-up strikes. Now, it's interesting, in that situation, they actually had a pretty sizable strike fund at their disposal, which, coupled with the tactic they used of those stand-up strikes, they could have sustained that strike for a very long time, and that's, of course, what gave them the leverage. So, no, I wasn't surprised to see labor leaders here in Connecticut try to get more leverage behind their strikes. And of course, you know, they interpret the governor's actions as sort of siding. If he's not helping them, he's helping the other side. Yeah. So You know, not surprised by that language. We're, again, labor very elbows out in this environment. And one would say that that's probably their role in this system. And the governor's role, of course, to either sign or veto, and he's chosen to veto.
And finally, Mike, who do you have on the program this Saturday, tomorrow?
So no surprise, Paul, we're talking a lot about Bridgeport tomorrow. So I had my colleague, News 12 Connecticut political reporter John Craven, for a breakdown of the news. John also staked out Ms. Jeter Padicke's house with me, not with me, but at the around the same day that I was there. We'll talk to him. Talk to Attorney General William Tong, not about Bridgeport, but about the pending Supreme Court decisions and the already issued Supreme Court decisions on everything from abortion medication to bump stocks. We spoke with him. He's filed amicus briefs in many of the high-profile cases this session. And then finally spoke with State Senator Rob Sampson, who is the top Republican on the committee in the legislature that oversees elections. Mm-hmm. Rob has been up in arms about potential abuses of the absentee balloting system for years now. And I don't want to say he feels vindicated by what's happened in Bridgeport, because, of course, nobody wants to be in a situation like what's happening in Bridgeport. But certainly Rob's someone with a lot to say on efforts to, in his view, better secure the absentee balloting process. Rob's probably the most conservative member of the state Senate, and I think he offers some pretty good perspectives on what the legislature can and, in his view, should do on this issue.
All right. Every Saturday, including tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., the Mike Cerulli Show right here on WICC. Mike, have a good show. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
Great to chat with you.
All right, thanks. Mike Cerulli there. You see him all the time on News 8, near the top of the newscast, in news speak, in news parlance. Mike is in the A-block. You know what they lead off with? The A-block stories. Mike is usually right there in the A-block, trying to, as I do on my show, as Lisa does on her show, as Melissa does on her show, to make sense of everything that goes on with the governance here in the state. So check it out, the Mike Cerulli Show, tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. right here on WICC. Chris Caruso is with us, former Democratic state rep on all things Bridgeport, all things Connecticut. Mr. Caruso, good afternoon, sir, and how are you? Chris, you there?
Yeah, sir. Can you hear me, Paul?
Yeah. You broke up a little there, Chris. Yeah, I thought you were heading into the Bermuda Triangle of Bridgeport, never to be heard from again. You know, many go.
Happy Friday, Paul. We made it through another week.
Yes. What do they say, Chris? Many go, but few return.
That's right.
let's talk about the four people charged here, Chris. That was a big story from the past couple of days. Three connected in some way, shape, or form to the Ganim campaign. One in some way, shape, or form to the Moore campaign. We're still dealing with 2019 here, Chris, not 2023. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, you know, Paul, I was personally affected by the corruption that year in 2019. I was a candidate for town clerk on the slate of Senator Marilyn Moore that year for mayor. So I was affected as every other candidate and, frankly, every citizen of the city. So would I have liked to have seen the case gone to the state's attorney's office quicker? Of course I would. But I'm also very happy that it finally has made it to the state's attorney's office and they're prosecuting, which is critically important. I don't think you can, you know, minimize tampering with a witness or the possession of absentee ballots as something that's, you know, minor or that, you know, much ado about nothing. No, those are serious charges. And, you know, the interesting thing, I know several prosecutors, and I think one thing that I would describe them as attorneys is they're cautious. Mm-hmm. Because before they bring a case for criminal action, you know, they have to be able to substantiate claims and evidence in order to get a prosecution. They don't take that lightly. You know, the burden of a criminal conviction is much higher than civil in the sense sure. that, you know, you're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And so it's much higher. So they take it seriously. And I think in this case, they probably have enough evidence or they'll probably gather more that will make the case stronger. And, of course, every defendant is innocent until proven guilty under the rule of law. And I think that's important. And they'll have their time in court to prove their case or to, you know, go against the evidence or prove the evidence is incorrect, whatever the case may be. But I'm happy that finally the state is taking this seriously. and pursuing prosecution. I think every citizen should be pleased with that. And I don't think this is the end, frankly. It's the beginning, because as you've stated, there's still charges in the 2023 that have to be filed and arrests made. But something has to happen. I think this is the right approach.
You know, Chris, somebody in the front office, a connoisseur, we were talking about this the other day, just kind of in the kitchen milling around, and this person said to me, they said, "Do you think this?" And I said, "What?" And they said, "Do you think now they finally moved on the 2019 thing, and particularly with a couple of people who are kind of leading the headlines, Chris, only because, you know, at least one person, and again, allegedly, still innocent until proven guilty, is implied in 2019 and 2023. So this person said to me, do you think they're getting close enough on 2023, which, of course, we had the video in, to say, well, wait a minute. 2023 is fine, but we still have to do something for 2019 that may bolster our case for 2023. What are your thoughts on that?
I think there's probably some truth to that, Paul. And frankly, I don't think the state's attorney could have let this issue go away. I don't think there's any way that you could have swept it under the rug or you ignore it. It's a serious crime. You know, tampering with the ballot, you know, the absentee ballot is as serious as walking into a polling place and, you know, going in and voting for someone, or walking into the booth when someone's casting their vote. You know, the sanctity of the ballot, whether it's at the polling place or whether it's in your home as an absentee ballot, remains the same. And I don't think prosecutors could have walked away. And, you know, people are criticizing the State Elections Enforcement Commission. Well, under statute, they can't handle criminal cases.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have the power of prosecution.
And so they're undermanned, Chris. And, Chris, they're understaffed, right?
Paul, when I created the public financing system, we fully staffed that department with investigators and attorneys and so forth, because I knew the importance of getting it right, that if someone violated the law, we needed to prosecute or pursue it. Over the last several years, the legislature has slowly dismantled that department. They've required now that if a claim is brought against an individual, within 1 year, they have to dispose of the case or the case is dropped. Now what they've done is they said within 90 days under the new legislation, within 90 days, SEEC has to refer it, if it's criminal, to the state's attorney's office. Mm-hmm. The problem that you have is SEEC has been set up for civil cases. So what they do is they prosecute in the sense of getting the defendant to acknowledge the problem and then pay a fine. And that fine goes back into the system, the SEEC, in order to keep it operating. That's part of the problem. And the other side is that it's civil. It's not criminal.
Yeah.
What if the legislature said that, you know, criminal claims go automatically to the state's attorney's office? They have a white-collar division crime area now. That could go directly there. You know, the state's attorney, because they're the prosecutors of the state, have many more resources, many more opportunities at their disposal to completely investigate. But you know what will happen is the legislature won't do that because they're afraid that, you know, some of their supporters or of their political operatives will get caught in the web. Yeah. And, you know, but too bad. You know, if we believe that elections are important enough, if we believe in the fairness of elections, then we can't spare anything to make sure that they work right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let's look at SEEC. Let's look at how they've been dismantled over the years and changes in the statute and their powers. You know, let's look at, you know, their right under the judicial system as far as, you know, doing civil cases rather than criminal. There's all those things that need to be looked at, but understand, you know, a five-year case is a five-year case. You know, they should have pursued it sooner, but, you know, they were probably looking for, you know, frankly, you know, some type of fine that the defendant paid or that, you know, the claim brought against the person pays, and let it go at that. So it's a whole different way of approaching it, you know.
Yeah. Chris, finally, before we let you go, kudos. Yeah. I think I want to get your thought on this. But, you know, I said good on Governor Lamont for vetoing that bill that would some say would funnel state money to striking private workers. And Chris, you know, I read all the reaction from some people in the General Assembly and some people with big labor and their fire breathing and everything. But, Chris, I don't know about you, but kudos to the governor for saying, you know, this is not the way you do things. We can debate whether this is a good idea, but we don't do this at the 11th hour as the sun is setting and the moon is rising on a legislative session.
Yeah, you know, the one thing about this governor, which is very interesting, Paul, he has guts. And
yeah.
He had guts in this case. You know, it's not easy, you know, because many unions have supported him mm-hmm. over the years and the Democratic Party. But he wasn't criticizing the unions. And he also didn't say this law shouldn't pass. What he was saying is there's a process. Mm-hmm. Let's do it the right way. And you know, next year the legislature can go through the process, have the hearing, you know, hear the pros and the cons and vote accordingly. That's basically what he's saying. I think people are saying, well, he's against strikers. No, I don't think that's the case at all. He's really underscoring the process which needs to happen. And frankly, the move by a couple of the leaders in the General Assembly was wrong, putting $3 million into the budget without any identifying factor, you know, where that money is going to go or what it's going to be used to. It was really kind of a last-minute shenanigan. And, you know, that's never good. Legislation never works well when you do those things. You know, put it out in the public hearing process. Let people come up and speak, pro and con, and then the legislature makes a decision accordingly. I think that's basically what the governor is saying. You know, separate from the merits, whether or not striking
sure.
workers should receive
sure.
State funding, that's a secondary issue. But the process itself, I think the governor was right in honoring, you know, his veto. I think that was the right thing to do at this point. And it wasn't just on this case. There's been other little shenanigans going on with some leaders in the General Assembly where they're sticking things into bills that you read about later. And some of them deserve the hearing process. Some of them deserve, you know, proper venting of the issue so that it's not just rushed through.
Yeah, Chris, if they're afraid to do it the right way, then they're afraid for a reason, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, the truth be told, there's enough support up there to create a fund for striking workers. The support is there. So you do it the right way, and you avoid all the criticism and everything else, and you just do it the right way. And I think that's basically what the governor is saying. You know, some of the union leaders, and I've always supported organized labor
uh-huh.
because I think they're a great organization. They've helped people tremendously over the years. My dad was a Teamster.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the whole, you know, labor movement and the process and concept. But, you know, some are criticizing him. He didn't come out and say he's against it. He's
yeah.
just saying, let's look at the process, do it the right way, and see where it goes from there. And I think that's the right thing to do. It's the fair way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Chris Caruso, Chris, as always, great thoughts. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you, sir.
Yes, happy Father's Day, Paul.
You too, and thanks, Chris. Appreciate that. All right. And Flag Day today, by the way. That's right. Chris, thank you. Appreciate that. Our next guest is Andrew Bridge. Now, Andrew's first book, entitled Hope's Boy, was a New York Times bestseller, Washington Post Best Book of the Year. He grew up in foster care. He started his legal career representing kids in Alabama State psychiatric hospitals and mental health facilities. Later on, he moved on to become the executive director of the Alliance for Children's Rights in Los Angeles, where he did work to expand free legal services to kids in foster care and poverty. He is also a founding director of the New Girls Academy School. That's California's first all-girl college prep school for pregnant and parenting teens. He's also a co-founder of National Adoption Day. He currently serves on the Arizona Foster Care Review Board. He's a graduate of Wesleyan University with a Connecticut connection right there and the Harvard Law School. He is a Fulbright scholar and a resident at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center. He lives with his partner, Dr. David Scott Young, at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona. His new book is called The Child Catcher. He chronicles his role in the longest running, most bitterly fought mental health lawsuit in American history. We welcome to the program Andrew Bridge. Andrew, Paul here in Connecticut. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you much for having me. I appreciate it. Good to
well,
hear your voice.
You go on to the Hall of Fame immediately, Andrew, as having far better business cards than I. Where do you find time to to do anything else? God bless you for what you're doing, but man, do you ever have any downtime?
It is a lot of work, and, you know, working on and finishing The Child Catcher certainly took a lot of work. That was my second book. The Child Catcher actually is included in Hope's Boy, which I was fortunate to, you know, have do well. And what it is, The Child Catcher is about the very first lawsuit that I worked on out of law school. So I'd been out of foster care at that point for about 6 years, and I went to represent children in foster care and mental health hospitals in Alabama. And the facility that I worked with was a place that thousands of kids had gone through. Mm-hmm. Two boys had tried to commit suicide. One boy had died, and it was about rescuing those kids from that facility. It's very much The Child Catcher is very much about just what's going on with parents today trying to get help for their kids.
Yeah, before we get to that and get to that heinous-sounding facility here, what was your experience like in your youth growing up in the foster care system? What was that like? Explain that to my audience, if you can.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the first place that I was taken from, I was 6 years old. My mom developed paranoid schizophrenia. She was a single mom, mm-hmm. and I was taken from her literally down the street, grabbed from her arms, and put into a car and driven to a large compound that Los Angeles County ran called McLaren Hall. That was an abandoned polio hospital that the county had taken and decided to start putting foster children in. It was a violent, chaotic place. There's currently a major lawsuit about McLaren involving thousands of people who were mm-hmm. assaulted at McLaren. And I spent a year there. So from age 6 to 8, that was my life. And it never leaves you. After that, I was moved on to one foster home. It wasn't a very good foster home, but the thing is, I stayed there and I worked hard and teachers liked me and I did well. And I was fortunate enough to get a full scholarship to Wesleyan and then go to law school. I was a lucky guy.
Yeah. How often growing up, Andrew, did you say to yourself and try to stop saying, or maybe you didn't try, why me? Why am I going through this? Why can't I have what other kids have? Did that bother you?
You know, I think I felt like a lot of kids do. I think I felt different. I felt like I wasn't like other kids. And I think when you talk to kids in foster care today, that's what they talk about and what bothers them. That they feel like they're not like other kids. They're foster kids, and that means their lives are run by a system. They're not run by a mom and dad. They're not run by a family. They're run by a system. They're run by people who they don't know, and that makes them frightened. It makes them scared and makes them feel like they're not loved.
And I hate, you know, I hear words like that, and the one that I always say on my show, Andrew Bridge, that drives me nuts is, and I guess we don't say it as much as we used to, you know, I hear that and I hear think of immediately illegitimate child. I mean, man, you know, foster child, illegitimate, no, they're children. I mean, it drives me nuts when we have these, and I know there's a descriptor needed, but we have to do better with that.
Yes, we do, and I think if you talk to kids, one of the first things they will also say is, would you please just stop calling me a foster child and just call me a kid?
Yeah.
Because that's what they want to be. And that's what they remember they were one at one point. That's what I was before I was taken. Mm-hmm. And that label sticks and it hurts.
Tell us about The Child Catcher here in McLaren Hall and get into some detail, if you will, Andrew, as to why you chose to tell this story and what you hope listeners, if they buy your book, and certainly I hope they do, can get out of this.
Sure. Well, The Child Catcher is about the very first lawsuit that I took right after graduating from law school. At that point, the longest time that I had ever spent in a courtroom was in my own foster care proceedings. I had no idea what to do. And I was taken up with a small team of civil rights lawyers who were taking part in one of the longest running, really most bitterly fought civil rights lawsuits in Alabama. And I was given a place called the Eufaula Adolescent Center. Thousands of kids had gone through that place. This was a place that kept kids in underground passages, kept kids in cells. Kids were seriously hurt there, and the state of Alabama insisted on keeping that running and insisted on sending children there. And so it was the fight to close that center. Now, the thing that was awkward and very difficult for me was that it was very, very much like McLaren Hall, where I spent time as a boy. And these sort of places continue to operate across the country. These are places that are run by private corporations and by states. They bring in billions of dollars, and it's something that needs to be stopped.
How hard was it to control your emotions doing this, Andrew, reflecting back on McLaren Hall, going after Eufaula? Or did that fuel you? Or did that make you dig in more and say, no, this is the right thing to do?
That's a great question. You know, and the honest answer is a little bit of both. It meant when I walked through Eufaula's gates, mm-hmm. Which it was an abandoned radar base that had been acquired top of barbed wire. Part of me kind of knew what was going on. Part of me felt like, you know, remembered what this was. Wow. And so that helped me. And it certainly helped me when I sat down and I talked to kids and I asked them what it was like there, because I remembered. And so I could have conversations with them in that way. The other thing, though, was I went down there largely alone. And there were times, certainly, when I was alone with a staff member in a room, for example, alone in a basement where they were keeping kids, or alone in cells where they were keeping kids. And that was pretty scary. You know, I will never forget the first time that I actually discovered these. It was an abandoned radar base, and so they had a brig, and they kept children in this brig. And the first, they tried to cover it up. It's covered up with, wood. And the first time finding that and walking into one of those cells alone with a staff member, that was pretty scary. But it meant a lot. And, you know, what I want to say, and I do just have to say this, one of the reasons why I wrote The Child Catcher is that the children and the families who were affected by that place are still around, still suffering. So I mentioned one of the boys, two boys hanged themselves. One boy survived, the other didn't. The boy that survived is still being cared for by his parents. They are still struggling. They received very little money from the state of Alabama to cover what had been done to their child. And the kids that went through those facilities are still struggling too. And it's happening all across the country. These sort of residential treatment facilities are facilities that operate, and they make a promise to parents. They say, if you're having trouble with your kid, your kid's sneaking out, your kid's maybe not talking back, not doing what you would like it, your kid's being hard, send us your kid, we'll make him better.
Wow.
They don't do that. What they do is they go ahead and they take children and they make a lot of money from them. And they're very expensive. They run up anywhere between $80,000 to $120,000 a month. And they take in lots of foster kids and lots of kids from the community. And that's what The Child Catcher is about.
Were you ever threatened when you were there? Did you feel unsafe, as you said, with the staff members there? And you're trying to do your job. You're trying to get to the bottom and help these kids. Did you ever did you ever look over your shoulder and say, uh-oh, you know, is this a bad horror movie here? I mean, were you ever scared?
Yeah, no, I was definitely scared. There were times that, you know, certainly having, you know, someone get in your face and say things like, you're not going to win this time, and you're standing there alone. That's pretty intimidating. And you know that you are thousands of miles from your home. You're thousands of miles from that civil rights office where you work. You are alone, and you're going to drive back from this small facility to a little motel that's right outside it, and that's where you got to be, and they know that's where you are. So this is a place, for example, where investigative reporters want to go down to see it, and they'd find things like their car was vandalized.
Wow.
When they did, because what these things do and what this thing did, it was a place where it made a lot of money for the local economy. It provided jobs in a very poor area. And so The Child Catcher talks about how these places provide money for local areas, but really hurt kids.
Wow. Name of the book is The Child Catcher, A Fight for Justice and Truth. It's in hardcover. Pick it up Amazon, wherever you get your books. It comes out the 24th of this year, September 24th. So put it on your wish list there on Amazon or wherever you get books. The guest, Andrew Bridge, now an attorney, once a foster child himself, and a graduate of Wesleyan in Middletown. Andrew, thank you. Good luck on this. What a story to tell. Give you all the credit in the world for doing something like this. And hopefully we can chat down the road. Andrew, thanks. Appreciate the time.
I love that. Go Cardinals. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. All right, there is Andrew Bridge. Man, what a story. Oh.